New York, you're perfect. Oh, please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect, I mean all disrespect. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Lowenstein, who's the author of The End of Wall Street, out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. His other books include When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble, and Its Undoing, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Lowenstein.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
And clearly, your account of what happened on Wall Street in 2008, it doesn't look like the players have changed their bad habits, given what just happened with J.P. Morgan Chase. And it was extraordinary to see that how much we'd seen that movie before, where a division in London is off the reservation making risky bets, and that and then it cascades back to Wall Street. I recall that happened with AIG, and there's a pattern here, surely.
Well, the instrument certainly was the same, the credit default swap that AIG used, but obviously the size is, you know, orders of magnitude less. J.P. Morgan Chase is in no, you know, trouble financially. It's going to remain even profitable in this quarter. I think what we're dealing with now isn't so much the main body of the book that we, you know, that we saw unfold in 2008, but this protracted epilogue in which we're trying to figure out what controls do we need to prevent the sorts of things that happened in 2008 from happening again. And how do we write them? Because, you know, as we've heard ad infinitum, the financial system is complicated. We want banks to be making loans. We want them you know, to be strong financially. So therefore, we want them to be taking risks, right? But on the other hand, we don't want, you know, in this case, one of the most respected banks there is, thinking it was reducing its risk and going out and losing, you know, upwards of two, maybe $3 billion. So this tells us that, and this is occurring just as they're trying to put the finishing touches on two sets of rules that are meant to corral this, one being the Volcker rule against trading and the other an across-the-board set of rules about derivatives. So I think this certainly tells us that the you know, the follow-through from the crisis, the regulatory work, is a lot remains to be done.
So the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the 1%, which started, of course, on Wall Street in Zuccotti Park, that's clearly affected the debate, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think this is really going to be a very interesting issue in 2012 between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama because, well, with the added, Philip, that Mitt Romney comes from private equity. So, you know, I think they're going to offer very contrasting visions. You know, Mitt's going to say, I've spent my life, or before he became governor, his private enterprise life, looking for good companies to buy, trying to make them more efficient. You know, he's going to point to successes like Staples. He's going to say there were some failures, but that's what you get in capitalism. That's the system, and this is what you want, having bright people, find companies that can be improved, taken back public, and, you know, set on their way. And Obama is going to say that, you know, these things rely on a tremendous amount of debt, that there's, you know, more often than improving the companies, that there's financial engineering, creating profits for the bankers in the middle, but lost jobs and not any real efficiencies, and also lost taxes because of the great debt taken on, but not any real improvements. And you know, I think those, and that therefore we need more rules in the game. And I think those two contrasting visions, if they sort of each have the courage of their convictions to let that argument play out, you know, could offer us a very profound difference in November.
Well, there appears to be an overriding question here about the future of American capitalism and in what you just said. My understanding is that as our economy becomes more and more financialized and Wall Street takes up a bigger and bigger chunk of the economy, we're in danger of the extraction model, the extraction concentration model, extracting wealth and concentrating at the top, not just being the norm, but being the future. And, you know, maybe there's no way that America can go back to a manufacturing economy. But the contrast is pretty stark between extracting wealth and creating wealth. And the rubber barons of old, for all of their failings, created wealth. They created jobs.
Right.
They created products. What do these guys do? That's a question a lot of lay people in this country have is, what do? They seem to shuffle paper money around and make money off that.
Well, in the case of private equity, it's particularly outrageous because a large share of their profits are taxed at only 15% rather than the top 35% now and going to 39% that everybody else, you know, that a corporate executive, even a bank executive, someone in a doctor, a lawyer, whatever industry would pay, and why financial engineering is privileged to pay a low rate is really one of the outrages. But the question of how to fix inequality isn't so easy because we seem to have a system where, say, top lawyers make a lot more than the other lawyers in their firm, and the top athletes, the Michael Jordans and so on of the world, make a lot more than everybody else. And so would limiting how much they earn, would that help other people? Would that recreate solid middle-class factory jobs that used to exist? It's obvious that since we live in a global economy and we're, those factory workers are competing against factories in, all around the world, that alone is not going to do it. And so it's a lot easier to be unhappy about the level of inequality than to figure out, and it's a lot easier to find ways to chop the top down to size, namely tax them, than it is to figure out, well, how can we get the bottom and the middle to start rising? And that's, that is really the question that has plagued economic planners and thinkers since, the 1980s. And if either candidate could come up with an answer to that one, they'd really be onto something.
Well, I'm certainly not naive enough to expect and demand social good from Wall Street, but I think the argument is a question of how much social ill, how much predatory activities hurt Americans and hurt American consumers. And a stark example of that is how much the price of oil has been gamed and run up. And
I think I agree with you. I think there's too much trading, and I think there is a social good that finance in Wall Street plays, and that social good is raising money for industry, for new companies, for Silicon Valley, for there's some new manufacturing companies now in the Midwest sprouting up again, and the role of Wall Street is to aggregate the savings of lots of small and medium sized savers throughout the country in stocks and bonds and pool them so industry can create jobs and so on. But if you look at a Goldman Sachs, which was the Cadillac, the gold standard of raising money, of being an investment bank, that function is now something like 18% of its business, and basically all the rest is trading and trading type functions. And trading is basically a zero sum game where it's a casino type activities where somebody wins, somebody loses, but there's no net addition of capital into the economy. And unfortunately, for the Goldmans of the world, that type of activity has become more lucrative than the social good activity, which is raising capital.
Well, it's gotten to a point of almost surreal that they're moving their computers closer and closer to the stock exchange in order to get that millisecond advantage.
Yeah, I can't see this super trading I can't see any reason, frankly, to allow computers to trade, these computers that try to exploit so-called inefficiencies that appear and disappear within a fraction of a second. I mean, it just takes me back to the character Hal, who, of course, was a computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And the whole area of credit default swaps, which are basically an unregulated way of buying and selling insurance, which are really just, you know, a huge gambling casino. You know, I think of the most notorious example of trading activity with no social good, and this is what you referred to at the top of the interview, the real potential for harm, as we saw, of course, with AIG in 2008 and in a small way with J.P. Morgan this week.
So again, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, the author of The End of Wall Street, which is out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. So in terms of what just happened with J.P. Morgan Chase, the loss of $2 billion, perhaps $3 billion, out of a small unit in London, a French trader whose nickname was the London Whale, apparently made these trades. His boss, she was recently fired. But to get a handle on what he was up to, Roger Lowenstein, he was trading in derivatives and trying to hedge, but was obviously taking risks at the same time. And it brings up this question of the Volcker Rule and whether there is a way that you can put a regulatory wall between hedging and taking reckless risks.
You know, if I've been reading the accounts correctly, I think there might be. It's J.P. Morgan, like other banks, had a lot of exposure to Europe, and at some point, I believe last summer, they got worried about this, meaning they had loans out to companies and probably to countries too in Europe, and they wanted to hedge it. So they basically bought very large insurance policies, just like you and I would buy one, say if our house burns down, would be paid off. In this case, they bought insurance against there being a calamity in Europe. And they did it via the derivatives market. And as far as I understand, the Volcker Rule would allow that because you're trying to reduce the risk on your portfolio. It's called portfolio hedging. At some point then, between last summer and now, and this is where they got into trouble and I think skirted what the Volcker Rule would allow. Of course, hasn't been implemented yet, so they weren't violating the rule. But they said, you know, Europe doesn't look so bad. We don't really need all this protection, and they made bets the other way. What they were doing then was selling insurance to other people who still wanted protection against Europe. Now they were in the position of the insurance seller, not the insurance buyer. And I think they bought too much of this. They more than balanced out their previous position. Recently, Europe has again come a cropper with the turmoil in the French and Greek elections and the trouble in Spain, and they took a huge hit. So one could argue that in a post-Volcker Rule world, they'd be allowed to do step one, but not step two, and they wouldn't have had this loss. Now, you know, whether they would have stopped after step one and before step two, because it does seem as though they themselves were unaware of the risk they were running. You know, we'll have to see. This stuff is complicated, and it does make me nervous.
Well, it's complicated, but on the other hand, I've been covering Europe for some time now, and it's been pretty obvious that the ECB has not gotten their hands around this crisis, that it's gone on longer and longer, and the more it goes on, the worse it gets. It's just extraordinary to think that somebody could have bet in the opposite direction, particularly at a time when Greece was unraveling, and as you mentioned, Spain is going through a banking crisis as well. But it gets to the question, Roger Lowenstein, I don't know whether this is an accurate figure, but this is the one that's being bandied about, is that there are $700 trillion in derivatives looming out there.
Well, the figure is accurate, but you have to know what the figure is accurate, what it says. People frequently phrase a derivative bet this way. They'll say, I will pay you if the price of wheat goes up, you'll pay me if it goes down, and we'll say, let's make this about the amount will be how the movement, the total movement, will say in $1 billion worth of wheat. So then that'll count as $1 billion worth of derivatives. Now, if the price of wheat moves, say, 1%, you or I would lose or gain $10 million, not $1 billion. But that we're betting over the movement in $1 billion, and there are derivative bets, to use your figure, over the movement of $700 trillion. Now, no one's going to lose $700 trillion. It's going to be a fraction of that, and many of those bets, you know, they'll cancel each other out. People will be on one side of one and then the other side of a similar bet. So it's, you know, all you can say for certain is, 10 years ago there were a few trillion. So the size of derivatives has just exploded, and they cry out for more regulation and supervision. And this brings me back to the Dodd-Frank call on the regulators to write some tough rules, and unfortunately, these rules have been in the regulatory process really whittled down as Wall Street has lobbied Washington.
Well, there's no question that the banking lobby is perhaps one of the most powerful in Washington, and the fact that they've been successfully whittling it down is a measure of their influence. But some time ago, Warren Buffett referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. He's often considered fairly prophetic. He certainly has a pretty good track record in terms of making money for his shareholders. What do you make of that statement?
I think he's right. Notwithstanding, Warren Buffett has played with some weapons of mass destruction himself, but so far he hasn't gotten burned on them. I think when you do something, in particular, credit default swaps. There are lots of types of derivatives. If you buy a corn futures contract, that's a derivative. There are all sorts of derivatives. But if you sell a credit default swap, which literally means you're giving someone else the right to stick you with whatever the loss is in a default, in a credit default, you're really assuming insurance risk, and you're doing it without a state insurance commissioner looking to see if you've evaluated the risk, if your capital is sufficient, all the things that have basically protected the traditional insurance industry, for generations. And I think, in particular, credit default swaps are weapons of mass financial destruction.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Lowenstein.
It was a real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Lowenstein, who's the author of The End of Wall Street, which is out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. His other books include When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the NYC Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Looms as the Next Financial Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.